coming in and we are saying that the local districts can no longer identify the curriculum.
A bill to ban abortion providers from teaching sex education in schools narrowly moves ahead in the legislature. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Sitka basketball team helps rescue 11 people from a fire.
One lady, after we got 10 out, said her baby was still inside, and by that time, it was more than fully engulfed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans and communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A bill to revise oil and gas tax credits from the House Resources Committee includes only a fraction of the savings Governor Bill Walker proposed. The Department of Revenue estimates the bill would save the state roughly $160 million over the next 3 years. That compares with more than $1 billion in savings under Walker's proposal. The committee rejected a series of amendments yesterday that would have raised costs for oil and gas companies. For example, Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton proposed cutting the share of losses that North Slope producers can receive. The net operating loss tax credits would have fallen from 35% to 25%. Anchorage Democratic Representative Andy Josephson supported the amendment, which was defeated 3-6.
The credit system we've devised is not sustainable in this economic climate. And this would be a way to rein it in.
But Rena Delbridge says the credits help smaller and newer companies operate on the North Slope. She's an aide to Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hawker, who worked on the bill.
The net operating loss credit can also be thought of as a part of the fundamental tax calculation, in the sense that the state wants you to keep spending money even if you are losing money, because that spend is potentially that future production.
Walker's plan would have prevented companies from using past losses to reduce their taxes below the minimum, like they can now. And it would have raised that minimum tax from 4% to 5%. The House Resources Bill drops those provisions and also scales back Walker's proposal to cut tax credits. The debate over the bill is happening the same week the state forecast that it will pay out more in oil and gas tax credits next year than it will receive in royalty revenue for the first time. Despite the gulf between Walker's proposal and the committee bill, Tax Division Director Ken Alper credits the Resources Committee with its work over more than 20 hearings on the bill.
It was a respectful process. It was informative. They fixed a number of the technical issues that were in our original bill, and that makes things easier going forward. You know, and even if we disagree on some of where they went on the larger dollar value changes, we're going to continue the conversation.
The bill must go through more steps before it reaches Walker's desk. Next up is the House Finance Committee, and it will face scrutiny in the Senate Finance Committee. Last year, Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki was a member of a working group that recommended the state prevent companies from paying less than the 4% minimum. A Canadian company is looking into the feasibility of building a railroad to Alaska to link with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The rail line would carry oil from Canadian oil sands to markets in the Far East. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the company has been pursuing the project for years.
Matt Vickers admits he's touted the idea of shipping oil sands from Alberta to Alaska by rail for a long time. Vickers is CEO of G7 Generations Limited, a Canadian company. Vickers says the idea is to load more than 1 million barrels a day from Fort McMurray, Alberta, on a specially built rail line and take it to Delta Junction. From there, it would be treated to enter the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and head to Valdez. Vickers says the $35 million project got new life when the Alberta government funded a preliminary study for almost $2 million.
AE Tacoma, our engineering firm, were able to look at a route allowing our rail to be a Class A rail along the 2,400-kilometer or 1,600-mile route.
He says he spent much of the last 6 years getting buy-in from Canadian First Peoples and Alaska Native groups the plan impacts. If all goes according to plan, Vicker says, Canadian oil sands could be moving down to Valdez by 2020. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
A bill to bar abortion service providers from teaching sex education in public schools narrowly cleared a hurdle in the Alaska House today. KDLG's Hannah Colton has more.
Much of the public input around Senate Bill 89 has dealt with the birds and the bees. Its supporters want parents to have the final say on what kids see in sex ed classes, while its opponents say the bill would make it harder for students to get fact-based information. But as members of the House Education Committee considered the bill Wednesday morning, they were also concerned with the other things the bill does. For one, it says school districts may not pay for routine physical exams for teachers. Those exams are required in some, but not all, districts. And the bill requires parents to opt their kids in to not only sex ed classes, but also standardized tests. That last part was a major selling point for Representative Jim Culver.
One of the most significant sections of the bill recognizes the authority of a parent to withdraw their child from a standards-based assessment, especially after going through this, what I would call a useless top-down exercise with the AMP testing, and which is going on right now. And so I think that's very important to put that authority in statute.
Democratic Representative Ivy Sponholz, on the other hand, said the opt-in provision would create more hassle for districts.
I know that permission slips are already, you know, a barrier. And as the parent of three school-aged children myself, I can't tell you how many times I intended to sign something, it didn't get to it, or it got lost in a backpack. I'd fully would have signed the permission slip, but had to get a call from a teacher instead. And I just think that that's an unnecessary barrier that we're creating to, in theory, protect a right that we already have as parents, which is to pull our children out of sexual health education.
Republican Representative Paul Seaton says he's most concerned with the bill's impacts on health, that restricting access to sex ed could lead to more unplanned pregnancies and STDs, but that he also believes it takes power away from local school districts.
This is a state usurpation of local control, and this is, I believe, the first time in which we are coming in and we are saying that the local districts can no longer identify the curriculum.
Senate Bill 89 passed the Education Committee by a vote of 4-3. It now goes to the Health and Social Services Committee, which is chaired by Representative Seaton. It's not yet scheduled for a hearing in that committee. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Fishermen, Alaska Native tribal leaders, and clean water advocates are criticizing Governor Bill Walker's administration over its handling of fisheries and water issues. Chief among their criticisms is a bill Walker proposed to give the state legislature deciding power over which waters in the state could be classified as outstanding natural resource waters and offered special protections. Yakutat-Tlingit Tribal Council member Raymond Sensenmeyer says funneling applications through the legislature could politicize the process. The group also criticized the governor's 2015 decision to lift a moratorium on work on a major dam project and the state's denial of certain water rights for a group fighting to stop coal mining development near a salmon stream in south-central Alaska. A Walker spokeswoman said Walker's office planned to respond to the group's concerns. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a unique Aleutic quiver returns to Kodiak.
Most of the quivers I've seen are circular. This one was square, beautifully made and tied, but it should go home because it's so rare.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
bring the wisdom and the Alaska culture into the classroom while participating in crafts, telling stories, or teaching a language. Elders age 55 or older, apply at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc.
Quick thinking by the Sitka boys basketball team averted tragedy this morning when a sixplex in the Anchorage neighborhood where they were staying caught fire. The boys and their coach woke and rescued 11 occupants before firefighters arrived. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The Wolves were on their way to breakfast in their team van at 11 a.m. when Coach Andy Lee says the boys noticed flames coming from an apartment building.
We did a U-turn. And one of the guys called 911, and kind of the rest is history.
The Sitka basketball team was the first on scene. Lee says he saw a passerby taking pictures, but it occurred to him that something was not right.
And then I realized that no one was out of the apartment, so I kind of dispersed the guys to the perimeter to look for exterior doors and windows because it was too involved for me to put them at risk.
While the team alerted occupants from the outside of the building, Lee himself went in the entryway and pounded on all the doors of the sixplex. The residents, most of whom had been asleep, started coming out and were helped across the street by the basketball players.
We were a little bit afraid that there was propane tanks on the deck, so we wanted to get away from the building as soon as we could.
Lee says they were functioning on adrenaline because there were a lot of people to get out and the fire was growing quickly.
One lady, after we got 10 out, said her baby was still inside, and by that time, it was more than fully engulfed in kind of a moment of panic and turned to decide what to do, and a roughly 14-year-old girl came running out through the only exit point in the building, and she was the baby, and so everybody got out safe.
Lee says there was a wide age gap in the occupants of the building, under 15 and over 60, and that the working residents were most likely away when the fire started mid-morning. After breakfast, the team returned to the sixplex to check on the families they had rescued.
The elder woman in the home, the grandmother and kind of the matriarch of the Samoan families that were there, kind of hugged us up and took a picture with us and thanked us profusely and said they were just able to get back in and retrieve a few possessions, and the fire department was doing the mop-up.
Lee is proud of the conduct of his players during the emergency. He says there was no time to organize. They just found their stride, waking up the residents and moving them outside. He has little doubt that this would have been a different story if the Sitka players had not passed by when they did.
It had the potential to be a great tragedy because they were asleep. They were elderly. It was a bad, and there's only one exit point for all six apartments. And that was where the fire was.
Lee says his team is feeling good about their actions during the fire. He's not sure how that will translate to the basketball court during the state tournament this weekend. We're feeling good about ourselves, he says, but we take nothing for granted. We are humbled to have been there. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In Sitka, a citizens' task force has been meeting for several months to come up with a strategy for keeping the community's basic services while adjusting the tax structure. The task force is ready to reveal their plan called the Grand Bargain. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
With a budget gap to close and state funding growing ever more unlikely, how will Sitka make do? The task force says by striking a deal with its citizens. This is their idea. If citizens approve a ballot initiative to raise the cap on property taxes by 2 mils, the city will eliminate the sales tax on groceries. At their March 7th meeting, Cindy Gibson crunched the numbers and, lit by the glow of a projector, presented her findings.
The idea is that people that have homes that are more valuable can have the resources to absorb those expenses a little bit easier than people who are fixed income or maybe have bigger families and have these other expenses.
Her example compares two families. Let's call them Family A and Family B. Each one has a mom, a dad, and two kids, and spends the same amount on groceries. Repealing the sales tax, this would be just on food, not on any toiletries, would save them $825 a year. Now, if Family A's home is valued at $350,000, then the Grand Bargain would save them a bit of money. But what about Family B? Let's say they have a second home.
Maybe you own a second house that you rent. I own a house that's $350,000 and I live in a house that's $400,000. So you will pay $675 more per year.
By Gibson's calculations, this pattern also holds true for senior citizens and renters. Those who have more properties or more expensive properties will pay a bit more under this new paradigm. Task force members have also been divided on whether to assign these mill rates to a specific purpose. Hugh Bevan suggested dedicating the revenue from one of the mill rates towards bond payments on the Blue Lake Dam. Vice Chair Max Rule worried that would put Sitka in a bind.
If we get into dedicating one mill of property tax for debt reduction of the utility, then we're committed out there for 30 years, or those 30-year bonds? 35 years.
Other task force members wondered whether dedicating the mill rate to road maintenance would be a better sell to the public. But in the end, the task force decided to get more public input and leave the 2-mill bump undesignated for any one fund. And speaking of the dam, the task force is also recommending a $1.9 million subsidy from the general fund to the electric fund. This is important because mild winters and low oil prices have put Sitka out of pace with bond payments for the dam. Rates will likely increase again this year, and the subsidy is meant to keep that rate hike below 5%. On the cut side, the task force is proposing a $1.7 million cut to the general fund and $600,000 to the school district over the course of 3 years. They did not propose a cut to Sitka Community Hospital, which concerned Gibson at last Monday's meeting.
I kind of feel like if we're expecting our school to cut back and our city to cut back, the hospital is pretty big.
Hospital CEO Rob Allen is chair of the task force, though he was not present at this particular meeting. Right now, the city has budgeted $157,000 for the hospital, which goes towards capital projects and equipment. Rule felt this cost was too small to cut into. That being able to tell that to the people kind of captures the challenge before the task force now. They need to figure out how to tell the story of the decisions they've made and why they made them, seeking public input while also defending their choices. Here's Gibson again.
We think this is the solution. It's our job to communicate effectively enough that everybody else can understand why it's important and why they would want to do it.
And citizens aren't their only critics. The task force will present their final recommendations to the Assembly at a work session on April 12th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Kodiak's Aleutic Museum recently acquired a quiver that is a rare example of Aleutic craftsmanship. Sven Hawkinson is curator of Native American anthropology at the Burke Museum and recently passed the quiver and the arrow that comes with it along to the Aleutic Museum. Hawkinson is from Old Harbor and served as the Aleutic Museum executive director before moving to Seattle to work at the Burke Museum and teach at the University of Washington. Hawkinson says the King family from Kodiak brought the quiver and arrow to the Burke Museum, and he recognized the quiver as a rare find.
Most of the quivers I've seen are circular. This one was square, beautifully made and tied, but it should go home because it's so rare, and it'd be a nice addition to the kayak they're getting from the Peabody Museum, the Warriors kayak, because those quivers were used when they were kayaking. They were originally made to hold sea otter darts, so that the sea otter darts, when you instead of so they don't get damaged on the kayak, you'd be able to pull them out, shoot the sea otter, and keep going.
Hawkinson says the arrow would have been used for target practice. The museum may put the quiver and arrow on display this summer. As Arctic sea ice has retreated north during the last decade, walruses have adapted by changing their haulouts to take advantage of better resources and food. That's good for the walruses, but it's a problem for some Russian indigenous communities on the Chukotkin coast. Johanna Yurik reports.
Meeting during the Arctic Science Summit in Fairbanks, Edward Storr, an indigenous Chukchi from Nurshkan Chukotka, says one village, which has grown large from the meat of walruses from two traditional haulouts that no longer attract animals in big numbers, is missing the meat that once sustained them.
People have been living here thousands of years, and they choose this place which can provide them lots of food for a long time. So when situation is definitely changed, we got a problem, you know. We couldn't provide themselves with food.
Storr says it's been 10 years since the village had a good walrus harvest. The walruses have not disappeared. They've moved north to new haulouts near other much smaller native communities in Russia's Far East. In the old days, hunters would simply pack up and follow the animals. But now their communities are much more substantial and villagers are no longer nomadic. It also costs a lot of money and fuel to hunt far from the village. During the last decade, as haulout patterns have changed, Chukchi Russians have become active guardians of the haulouts near their villages. When walruses showed up to haul out at Point Lay in Alaska, Inuit contacted their Russian colleagues to advise them as they set about protecting their new neighbors. But even in places where the local haulout is encoded in Russian law with established rules, limited access, and a haulout manager from the nearby village, there are still problems. Elizabeth Kruger with the World Wildlife Fund, which has been working to help protect Pacific walruses as they adapt to climate change, says one village walrus haulout manager told her about discovering that a Moscow bureaucrat had given permission to a German cruise ship to visit the haulout. He found out when he woke up one morning to see motorized inflatable Zodiacs coming ashore unloading tourists in the closed area.
He went down to the beach where they were unloading the Zodiacs and tried to talk to the people who were in charge of the tour operation. They showed him their authorization to be there. And at that point, he had to decide what he was going to do. And he decided, since he couldn't tell them that they weren't allowed to come near the haulout, he would help them to be as unobtrusive as possible. He's very concerned about a stampede and the mortality that comes with a stampede.
Walruses are very sensitive to noise, smell, and sudden movements, which could set off a stampede, leaving many dead animals on the shore. According to Storr, there's very little choice about doing the best they can to protect walruses. His people see it as a responsibility because they've depended on the animals to sustain them through their history.
Walruses depended from us because we can help them to manage the situation, and we are dependent from the walruses because they give us something what we need, not just physical survival, I mean cultural identity. I mean, I would like my children can say, yes, we are Chukchi.
There's also a health and safety aspect to the programs established by Chukotkin coastal villages. Walrus carcasses left in the aftermath of a stampede can attract polar bears, which have moved onshore in larger numbers as the sea ice receded. And unlike the Alaskan Point Lay haulout, which is located 4 miles from the village, the Russian haulouts are literally right next door to villages, and no villager wants polar bears prowling the neighborhood. I'm Johanna Urich.
Royal Caribbean's Explorer of the Seas is scheduled to dock in Skagway this summer. It's the largest cruise ship to land in the gateway to the Klondike by about 1,000 passengers and largest to cruise Alaska waters. The vessel will also make port calls in Juneau and sail the Inside Passage and Tracy Arm. KHNS's Jillian Rogers has more.
Featuring shopping, restaurants, and pubs. But step outside and prepare to be truly amazed.
At over 1,000 feet long and 160 feet wide, the Mammoth cruise ship is on Skagway's roster this summer and next. With nearly 4,000 passengers on board, it'll be a modern-day stampede on May 23rd, the first day the ship arrives in port. The Explorer of the Sea boasts 15 decks, 10 pools, bars, shops, restaurants, even a rock climbing wall. Blaine Merrill works at the Skagway Chamber of Commerce and is a 25-year resident. He says the larger ship will be a boon to Skagway's economy, but with it comes challenges.
I think it's a really good thing. If they spread it out pretty, you know, more evenly through the week, I think it will help every business to function better, and I think sales will be stronger that way. It's hard when you compound the problem by adding, you know, 10,000, 12,000 people a day. it's a little too congested.
Having thousands of visitors in town at once isn't new. Merrow says a few times a week during the summer, Skagway is flooded with 10,000 people jostling for position at local shops, restaurants, and attractions. The Explorer of the Sea is scheduled for every Monday in Skagway from the end of May through September. On its first day in town, it will share the port with three other ships, bringing in a total of around 7,500 passengers, along with about 2,000 crew members.
You know, when you've got that many people within an eight-block radius where the shopping is all done and where people, you know, convene for eating and all that stuff, it's a lot of people in a small space.
But Merrow says Skagway business owners adjust as needed and continue each season to provide a one-of-a-kind experience. For the most part, he says residents are thankful for the tourists because it's how the majority of them make their living. Up until now, the biggest ship was the Ruby Princess, which holds around 3,000 passengers. The municipality is currently in the process of deciding what to do with $7 million in state money that was allotted to the now-stalled Gateway Project. A floating dock that could support even larger ships is on the wish list for that money. Tyler Rose works for the community's biggest tourist attraction, White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad. He says that while cruise lines book their own routes, communities try to recruit ships that they think will be beneficial. Rose says the trend is leaning more towards these larger vessels.
The cruise industry is a worldwide market, and these are our mobile assets. And so where they put them, is important, and we try our best to attract those ships to our port here in Skagway.
Rose says White Pass has made improvements and upgrades at the port to house the larger ship.
We're extending a mooring dolphin off of the railroad dock to accommodate, as well as some bollard upgrades and a few other minor improvements to the railroad dock structure.
As for Skagway's capacity during the really busy days, Rose says the train ride up to White Pass offers a relief valve for congestion, as do the myriad of other excursions that take guests out of town.
As far as overall capacities, I mean, I think that, you know, everyone is looking towards growth. I don't know what the limit is. I mean, folks probably would have said 20 years ago that we were close to capacity. There's still opportunity for growth if we're able to work in concert as a community towards that.
The Explorer of the Sea makes its debut in Skagway on May 23rd. The first cruise ship, the Crystal Serenity, arrives on April 29th. In Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robert Hannon and Johanna Urich in Fairbanks, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Robert Woolsey and Emily Kwong in Sitka, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Jillian Rogers in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Salmon Project is all about the ways Alaskans' lives are supported by salmon. Their vision is for a future where Alaskans continue to be strong, nourished, and connected through Alaska's salmon resource. Learn more and be a part of the project, including the regular fund competitions. Our lives are salmon lives. Learn more at salmonproject.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Did you know that Pick, Click, Give helps over 600 nonprofits across Alaska? Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $13 million to organizations benefiting everything from our youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive in Alaska. A small part of your PFD can make a big impact when you Pick, Click, Give. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation and Pick, Click, Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.